You're tuned to 91.7 KAXE, 90.5 KBXE. This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. Dave Eggers is the critically acclaimed author of numerous works of nonfiction and books for young readers. His novels include A Hologram for the King and The Circle, which was recently adapted into a film starring Tom Hanks. His new book is The Captain and the Glory. The last captain of the great ship, the Glory, has stepped down, and a brash and boastful man with no experience, no knowledge of navigation, and who has often complained about not even liking boats, steps forward to take over the ship. If this scenario sounds familiar to some of you, you're not alone. The Captain and the Glory has been described as absurd, hilarious, and all too recognizable, a wicked farce of contemporary America. Here is my conversation with writer Dave Eggers. The Captain and the Glory reads like a parable or an allegory. Can you tell us how you chose to use that kind of format? How did this book take shape?
Well, I've been covering the Trump era as a journalist by going to rallies and interviewing people affected by his presidency. But at the same time, every time I wrote something, it didn't seem to reflect the true absurdity of the time. And I felt like allegory or parable or satire or some kind of combination of those three was the only way that I personally could mirror the bizarreness, I think, and the heightened sort of unprecedented, beyond fictional nature of the moment. And so a couple years ago, I came upon the idea of setting it all on a ship. Instead of D.C., instead of sort of a real-world setting, it's the nation. There's a ship called the Glory that's the stand-in for the United States, and everybody on it encompasses, our entire population. So I shrunk the setting, shrunk the cast of characters, and that gave me the freedom to, better reflect and heighten the comedy and the horror and have the two exist very close side by side, and to tell a story that has a lot of overlap with the last few years, but departs from our own narrative. And I don't know, the process of sort of fictionalizing this was incredibly liberating and cathartic in a way. And then the beauty of it all is that I get to write an ending to what right now is uncertain.
What role do you think satire plays in our culture when a lot of us get our news from social media, and that's a mix of people and news and memes? I'm thinking of how instantly memes are created. Is satire still relevant today?
Yeah, I think more so than ever. And I think the satirists from The Onion to the late night comedians, to Samantha Bee, you name it. Even Jake Tapper is a cartoonist still and does satirical takes on the news. And I think I know that there was a fear when Trump was elected that you couldn't satirize somebody that was so self-satirizing and so beyond comical, I guess, on the face of it. But I think that we found that it's still very fertile ground. I think the one thing that hasn't been done is what I was surprised that hadn't been done was to do an actual literary fictional take on this era. And so when I started this a couple years ago, I wrote about half of it, created the setting and the rules of the world that the book takes place within, and then I set it aside for a year or so and came back to it maybe 9 months ago, and I still thought it illuminated things, at least for me, that are otherwise sometimes lost in the daily thicket of news and outrages and, like you say, memes. And I think that what fiction can sometimes do and storytelling can sometimes do is to see the forest for the trees and create a kind of a cleaner, linear narrative with a beginning and a middle and end and a little bit of clarity and a little bit of to step back and see things with a bit of perspective and to eliminate some of the noise and to get at some of the larger truths that are sometimes lost in the morass of the 24-hour news cycle.
You're listening to What We're Reading in our conversation with author Dave Eggers. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. The man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. I'd like to talk a little more about humor. We touched on satire and the absurd earlier, but I found as I was reading this book, I laughed at parts of it out of shock at how awful people can be. I think I'm trying to reconcile why we sometimes find humor in really horrible things.
Well, I think it's satire really is sublimated outrage. It's outrage, the hot lava of outrage cooled and shaped into a narrative form. So there's a deep pain that runs throughout the book because I the last 3 years have been really tough on the soul, I think, for all of us that care about the dignity of the Republic and expect, you know, a certain moral leadership coming from the White House, and that certainly hasn't been there. Depending on, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, we can agree that the office has not been led with dignity these last years. Any day reading the president's Twitter feed would obviate any argument that this is a dignified presidency. But at the same time, you know, and there's that superficial comedy of these last years, whether it's starting with the president's hair and demeanor and the absurdity of a Twitter feed that is misspelled every day and full of demonstrable fibs every day. I mean, there's a comical veneer to it all. But at the same time, I wanted to reflect the true horror visited upon millions and millions of people in the country, vulnerable people, immigrants, asylum seekers, who have been held in cages, deported without justification, treated with incredible malice and cruelty. And so even though the book is supposed to be funny, and I tried to make it funny, and I wanted that to exist in uncomfortable proximity to the true daily horrors that so many people experience every day these last 3 years.
On that note, are there any heroes in your story? And by asking that, I guess I'm asking you if you have hope for the future.
Yeah, I do. I got to write an ending to this story, which was really comfort, gave me a certain amount of comfort and catharsis, because we don't know where this is going ourselves right now. I think we know where the impeachment hearings are going, but we don't know what will happen in 2020. So there was a little bit of a temporary or even false comfort in being able to write an ending. And it's, you know, there's a young girl in the story who's about 12 who is sort of the moral voice of the ship, and she's the one person that sees the folly in electing what everybody would agree is the least qualified person on the ship to be the captain. Whatever you think about the captain, you have to agree that he doesn't know what he's doing. And his previous experience selling souvenirs by the putt-putt golf course does not carry over to the leading and navigation of a 300,000-ton ship full of thousands of humans that need to have a experienced and rational and even-handed leader at the helm. But I really do think that we will return to our better selves. And I think that we're a really fascinating and bewildering country where we could elect the last four presidents are such incredible pivots from each other. Every one of them is a bipolar shift from the one before. And so I think that that's our pattern, is that we really pivot hard every 4 to 8 years, and I think we're going to do that again. But I think that there are so many qualified, decent Republican candidates out there, so many qualified and decent Democratic candidates, and there are none that are as strange and I think disrespectful of the values that the country was built on as Trump. And so I think he really is once in a generation a complete anomaly, never to be repeated. So I am optimistic that we will return to some semblance of a dignified form of government that respects the rule of law and is not about the person, but about the underlying foundation of our Constitution and everything that the country was built on.
Dave Eggers' new book is The Captain and the Glory. This is What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.
Well, on the way, head in a cloud, the man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud, but nobody ever hears him or the sound he appears to make, and he never seems to notice what the fool on the hill sees, the sun going down and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. And nobody seems to like him. They can tell what he wants to do, and he never shows his feelings, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning.
The holiday season is upon us, and as I was planning my shopping list, I realized that for someone who loves books like I do, I don't buy them as gifts for anyone. I also don't receive them as gifts for myself anymore. I think it's because buying a book as a gift for someone is probably one of the most complicated tasks one can attempt, fraught with uncertainty, overthinking, and the fear of rejection. Have they already read it? Will they like it? What if they don't read it? Worse yet, what if they hate it? Is there another act in the world where we bare our souls and leave ourselves vulnerable than buying a book for someone? And let's not forget the anguish of those who receive a book as a gift. Should I tell them I already have this book? What if I never get around to reading it? Or worse yet, what if I read it but hate it? One year, I gave a boyfriend the Daily Show book for Christmas, only to unwrap his gift to me, also the Daily Show book. Books for kids, though, are a little easier. Picture books instead of greeting cards are a wonderful and popular thing to do now for baby showers. As a parent, you probably have a better idea of what your child has read, and book series are so popular and make an easy, convenient gift. As a kid who loved books, I couldn't think of anything more exciting than getting a new book. Anne of Green Gables, The Bobbsey Twins, Sweet Valley High, Choose Your Own Adventure, Lois Duncan, and every Judy Blume book made its way to me. One of my fondest memories is of my Grandpa Gus. Not a man of many words, we weren't especially close, there were 7 grandchildren altogether, but he started giving me Calvin and Hobbes comic books whenever I'd visit. I love Calvin and Hobbes to this day, and I still smile when I think of Grandpa in those books. Here are some other book-giving memories and stories from people in our northern community, Radioland.
When my kids were still home, they always had some series they were reading, so that was easy to know where they were at in the series. I could go look at their books in their room, and then I would continue on with the series. And it started with my son with Captain Underpants, and my daughter was Little House on the Prairie. And then they moved on to the Harry Potter books, which we all read together. And that started with my mother when I was very young. My sister and I used to read Trixie Belden books, and she gave us book after book of that series.
One Christmas when I was little, so I was probably 9 or 10, and my Aunt Sue is about 15 years older than I am, and she, along with my mom, were really the ones who got me so into reading as I was growing up. My mom with the library, and then Sue would buy me books and tell me about books she liked. Anyway, she took me to the Brookdale Mall in Brooklyn Center, which I'm not sure is even there anymore. We went to B. Dalton. And she looked at me and she said, "You can pick out 9 books." I think it was for how old I was. And that was the most amazing thing that had ever happened to me, I swear. I still have some of these books in my collection, and they really kind of guided me in the future. You'll know what I mean. Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle and A Wind in the Door. I got those as 2 of them. And then Secret Garden by Frances Hodges Burnett and The Little Princess. And I honestly don't remember all of the rest of them, but I know not only did she let me get that stack of books as my Christmas present, it was early, it was like beginning of December, and she let me take one of them home with me when I left as well. So for a little kid, maybe letting them pick out some things would be really fun and might really just lead them to reading in their life the way that it did for me.
I've gotten a little bit cynical about it because I used to always give books, always, always, always. Every year somebody got a book from me. I mean, everybody got a book from me. And then I realized that I think I'm giving these books to people because I want books. And I like these books and I want to read these books. And so now, not counting kids, because I would still give kids books to kids, young kids anytime. But now I pretty much only will give a book to someone if I absolutely know they want that book and that it's a good book and that I'm sure they will read it.
Every year my mom gives me a book for Christmas, and they're always so thoughtful, and I just love it. It's always my favorite gift.
Each year, I do give my dad a book. His birthday is just a couple weeks before Christmas, so I've kind of gotten into this tradition of, for his birthday, giving him a book. He usually really likes the books, and he has strong interests in certain people, country western stars like Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis, and he always enjoyed books about like JFK. I know I gave him a couple books on Obama that he really liked, and I was always happy to hear a couple of times. I know he said, "Lori, you know, 3 days after I gave him the book, he'd read it all." And yes, he just said it was so good, and he couldn't put it down, and that's just what he did. So it's a good thing. So I have to come up with a book here pretty soon, but I'm going down to Egan, my old stomping ground, and I will find the perfect book again.
my uncle had been stationed overseas in the Air Force Reserves, and his only job in Pakistan was to load and unload planes. He had nothing else to do. And like everyone else on my mom's side of the family, tend to get very obsessive, and he was obsessive about a certain author. All he did was read this author, and when he was done with him, he sent us a huge crate of books by Terry Pratchett. And so when I came home on college break for Christmas, I decided I was going to read this entire box of books, and I did, and I loved it, and I've never read another Terry Pratchett book since, because I think I got most of them under my belt.
My daughters are more into reusing, recycling, all that kind of stuff now. So they suggested, and we followed up on this, that everybody come to the table at Christmas time with two or three books, and we'll just put them all out on the table, and then people will pick the ones they want. And the ones nobody picks, will a person who brought them can either take them home again, or they can be donated to a library or whatever. But it was all books that people liked at some level. They weren't like their favorite books ever, but they were like, I read these three books and I thought they were really great. I think somebody else should read them. And so they put those out on the table, and then we all had fun with it.
I hope this has inspired you to think about giving a book to someone this year, whether it's something you know that interests them or if it's a book you love that you want them to love as well. I'm especially excited about that idea we just heard of each person bringing three books to the table and then taking turns selecting one. If anyone tries that out, we'd love to hear how it went. Thanks to Jordan Shearer for his top three books and all the people who contributed stories to this edition of What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski. A big thanks to you for tuning in to the show, and an even bigger thanks to our Northern Community Radio members who help support this great radio service. What We're Reading is also made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.